Good afternoon. Today we have Dacher Keltner, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, here with us. He is the faculty director of the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center, a renowned expert in the biological and evolutionary origins of human emotion. Dr. Keltner studies the science of compassion, awe, love, and beauty, and how emotions shape our moral intuition. His research interests span power, status, inequality, and social class. He is the author of the best-selling book, Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, The Compassionate Instinct, and most recently, what we're going to discuss today, The Power Paradox. Dacher, great to have you online. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well, Chris. How about you?
Very good. Very good. So I just want to ask you, why should we care about power?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. When I began the science of power 25 years ago, it wasn't really on my radar screen, and it really just seemed to be something we should care about in politics or in certain contexts at work or on the military battlefield. And I think what we've learned in the past 25 years about why we should care about power is that it, as Bertrand Russell says, is the fundamental medium in which we relate to other people. And so how well we're getting along with our romantic partners and our kids and our parents and work colleagues and people in our communities is really, I think, most fundamentally shaped by how we handle power.
But what exactly is power?
Well, you know, I think power, the idea of power and what it means really changes from context to context, culture to culture, historical period to historical period. But today where we've landed, you know, and in particular, when we think about the 21st century and the US and other cultures, is power is your capacity to influence others. And I would even add precision to that, to alter the states of other people. So your power at any moment in time rests upon your ability to influence the thoughts of other people, the emotions, what they're thinking about, what they're caring about. So it's really that moment-to-moment capacity to influence the states of others.
How does power show up in our everyday interactions? Can you give an example?
Yeah, you know, power is, you know, if you take Bertrand Russell's quote, that power is the basic medium in which we relate to others, what that means is that we are continually moving through our social lives and shaped by our feeling of power vis-a-vis other people, whether we can influence them or not. Let me tell you one dramatic way in which it really manifests in our day-to-day lives. You know, the power paradox, as I wrote that book, I was thinking about this context in which I grew up, which was my parents moved me to a very poor rural town in a very poor county in California, in the Sierras, the Sierra Nevada. And it was really striking to go from a middle-class neighborhood in Los Angeles to a very poor, lower-class, poverty-stricken neighborhood in this town. And I saw my friends, and they were always feeling, they're always sort of literally kind of sick and ill and having trouble and suspicious of authority figures and having trouble concentrating in class. And what we've learned is that moment-to-moment experience in their lives of how they felt in school and how they felt in our society is shaped by the fact that they're really disempowered, that just feeling like they don't have a chance to make a difference in society stressed out their bodies, stressed out their minds, and led to this feeling about life. So power is part of how we relate to everything.
You're saying a sense of powerlessness can actually have physical consequences.
Yeah. And you know, that really was the science that spurred me to do 25 years of research on, you know, what is power and what does it do to us, is people like Nancy Adler and Edith Chen and Greg Miller and others have been finding for 20 years that, you know, my sense of power and rank vis-a-vis other people directly activates regions of the nervous system that have a bearing upon my physical health. So if I feel less powerful than my neighbor for a various reasons, right, I'm literally showing higher levels of cortisol, greater stress reactivity in my nervous system. And that's a recipe for really troubled living, simply because I don't feel empowered in my daily life.
Okay, definitely. I'm going to ask you some questions about how we can feel more powerful. Before we go there, you talk a lot about enduring power.
Yeah.
Can you share what enduring power looks like?
I think this is one of the deep challenges of social living, right? Is to live a life where you really make a difference in the world, which is one way of defining power. And you really make an enduring difference in the world. So, you know, the impact you have in your kids' lives or your partner's lives or at work or, you know, in my case, a scholarly discipline that I'm part of. And enduring power, in the simplest sense, is really rooted in, you know, do I do things that continue to advance the welfare of other people? And then the implication is I'll have a really strong reputation in those people that will then feed into my ability to continue to influence others and continue to make a difference in the world. So more specifically, studies are finding, you know, I have an enduring influence on other people. I have a great reputation. I can have a great career if I'm generous and I give opportunities and resources to others. I have an enduring kind of power if I'm empathetic and I know and I really practice the ethic of empathy and listen to people carefully and, you know, take in what their wisdom is. Third piece, I think, is really about appreciation and gratitude. You know, Adam Smith, the great economist, felt that practicing gratitude was the foundation of strong economic systems or, you know, organizations. And we know now that when leaders and parents and, you know, community members really show appreciation to others and convey respect, those people will trust them, they will respect them, and they will work for them in ways that are the condition of enduring power. So enduring power relies on or depends upon other people wanting to collaborate with us.
You mentioned appreciation, you mentioned generosity and empathy. When we look at kind of the world today, though, power doesn't always show up that way. For example, I mean, we could just look at the recent elections. So how do you, in terms of what you're talking about, how does that compare to sort of the stereotypes of power that we see in authority figures?
Yeah, you know, I know. And it's almost jarring, isn't it, Chris, right? To like, well, there's this one model of power, the more collaborative model that really is deep in our social evolution, as I write about in The Power Paradox. And then we have the rise of xenophobia and the rise of hate crimes and the rise of right-wing authoritarianism and the rise of Trump, right? And that clearly in one sense, it challenges this thesis that I develop in The Power Paradox. And I think there are a few ways to think about it. One, and this is something that people interested in power have been grappling with very deeply, which is, and I take it on head on in the first chapter of The Power Paradox, which is that power, what happens in history and society isn't just the ruling elite or who is the president, right? There are a lot of changes in the world that are brought about by ordinary citizens, by, organizations that aren't part of the government, et cetera. So power is much more than politics and economics and the like. It's really about innovation. And there are so many examples today of how, in spite of what's happening in politics, a lot of good things happen in society and positive social change. You know, a second thing that I think that people have grappled with, you know, and this is with respect to Trump, who alarms me and unsettles me, is the thing, in a funny way, he is already the example of the power paradox, which is that as follows. He rose to his prominence, a lot of analysts are now recognizing, by creating a rhetoric or a discourse that really appealed to white working class whites who have been really left behind and are struggling in today's economy. And in fact, their health, as I review in The Power Paradox, is really suffering. So Trump had this kind of mode of campaigning that appealed to them and promised to them he'd lift up their welfare. But now what we're seeing is he's abandoning that, you know, that kind of discourse with the cabinet he's choosing and the like. And that's what I talk about in The Power Paradox, which is we rise to power by promising to advance the welfare of many, the greater good. And then power suddenly leads us to abandon those, that very promise, and gratify our own interests and our narrow concerns. And I think that's a useful way to already look at the Trump, quote, presidency.
Well, power must obviously operate on a transactional level, and you mentioned generosity, empathy. You haven't mentioned specifics in terms of Trump's behavior, but what are, for the listeners, what are some actions they can take in a dynamic in the office, for example, to come off as more powerful? Maybe you've seen some examples from your own colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's funny. Chris, I wrote this book before Trump, and we do know from 50 to 60 years of data, surveys from around the world in organizations and finance firms and nonprofits and sports teams and so on. I mean, even the Warriors, our local Warriors, their motto, they're the dominant team right now. Their motto is compassion, joy, mindfulness, and competition. So our culture has witnessed in many different areas this move towards more collaborative power. So, and that this whole discussion begs the question that you ask, which is, well, what do I do? I mean, how do I have power in an organization at work? How do I have power in a volunteer group that I'm part of? How do I gain power?
Yes.
And there, scientists like Cameron Anderson are testing these ideas. And what we're learning is it's really very simple. And I wrote a piece for the Harvard Business Review on this. Like, so it's really important to speak up, that when we voice our ideas in any group and speak up with care, we'll gain power. It's really important to share. And there are a lot of cool studies by Rob Willer at Stanford in sociology showing if I'm in a group and we're starting to form a hierarchy, and I share things, right? I help somebody out. I share an idea. I share a source of resources. I will gain power and respect. It's important to be bold, and strong. It's important, there are studies of the great presidents who show that one of the defining determinants of enduring power is being bold, put out a really radical idea. And finally, there is no substitute for great listening and great active empathic engagement with others. And there are neat studies by Mark Brackett at Yale, Stefan Cote, one of my collaborators who's at the University of Toronto, just showing, wow, those emotionally intelligent people who are just focused on listening really gain power in most contexts of interest.
To summarize that, be bold, speak up, listen with empathy, listen to what's going on. I mean, you mentioned, serving the greater good. Yeah. Is there anything else?
Well, sharing, right? That's really counterintuitive. But as Rob Willer and others, there's this new literature, ironically, that's called competitive altruism, which shows, it's really the person who shows generosity in newly forming groups who other people respect, and they have the sense that this person can really advance the values of the group and advance their welfare. So, and then I think we can't underestimate, with all this EQ stuff, emotional intelligence stuff, as one pathway to power, a clear other pathway that Cameron Anderson has been studying is competencies, right? Show your technical competencies, show your skills within a particular domain. That matters too.
How does one show skills without coming off as arrogant?
Yeah. Well, I've been teaching this for 20 years and to leaders in different kinds of organizations. And it's almost in how you deliver your knowledge and your skills. I was just with Kaiser Permanente and their Women in Leadership program. Kaiser Permanente now has three women who are medical directors out of the six, which is unprecedented, right, in terms of women leading. And they had these three pioneers really get up and talk about how they rose to power. And what you saw in how they talked about their their wisdom and their technical competencies and their medical, you know, sophistication in the domain is this respectful, collaborative, you know, engaged way of presenting their ideas. They're not domineering, they're not coercive, they're not trying to take people down. They're really trying to build. And I think those are qualities that we can imbue our knowledge and our competencies with that benefit power.
I was at a company, a startup many years ago. They had two co-founders, 100 employees. And one of the co-founders, he was the CEO of the company, 100-person company, right? He was your kind of typical alpha male. He would disparage people who he'd work he didn't like. He was very direct, very straight. The other was a VP, and he was really nice, generous. He listened. And was eventually one of the dynamics I noticed is the engineers loved the CEO. But the marketing, the sales guys hated the CEO, but they loved the VP, you know, the more social guy. So clearly it looks like different types of power dynamics work for different people.
Yeah. And, you know, Chris, your observation is so way beyond the science, right? So I think that you can think about how we gain power and lead. You know, and social scientists always reduce things in simplistic ways as there's kind of a collaborative model, a high EQ model of empathy and respect and, you know, and then there's a more top-down coercive model, if you will, of, you know, I dictate what goes on, I take people down. And those strategies are always vying for control in organizations, and they work in different contexts to different degrees, right? If you're doing a one-shot negotiation, or if you're dealing with a really nasty constituency or outside party, or if you're, you know, in the Mexican drug cartels, you want some coercive types on your side, right? Who are going to be strong and forceful. By contrast, you know, if you're in other parts of an organization like sales, where it's a lot more social and built on relationships, you probably want the more, you know, collaborative, high EQ person to be in leadership positions. So clearly they depend on context. They depend on who you're working with, who you're negotiating with, and also the kind of sector you're working in, right? You know, and when I travel down to Facebook and do consulting there, it's, you know, internally, it's a very collaborative, horizontal type of organization where the coercive types aren't going to do too well. So it really depends on the realm you're working in too.
The atmosphere or the context, the situation really matters.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. I always like, I work with a lot of, it's been one of the most gratifying dimensions to my career outside of science and teaching is working with women in leadership positions. And they're rising to power in unprecedented ways. And women, you know, they're a little bit more vulnerable to more coercive types trying to take advantage of them. They tend to be, studies show, a little bit more collaborative, which benefits their organization, studies show. But they also have to be on guard for making sure that they assert themselves in the right places, make sure they're forceful and strong when they need to be. So it's a real nuance, as any person who's been in a leadership position knows, you know, it requires multiple strategies and a sensitivity to context.
Given your work with different leaders, can you share a story about you, an actual situation you've seen this?
Oh my God. You know, I mean, one of my favorites, Chris, was, you know, I had the life-defining privilege of working as a scientific consultant on the film Inside Out, right? And Pete Docter, the director of that film, brought me in. And for 5 years, I'd visit his team and talk to Pete and his team, very small team of creatives that built up the film Inside Out, about the science of emotion, which I've been teaching for 25 years. And, you know, I was like, as I got a sense of, you know, I just confronted the question, like, how in the world does Pete get 250 people who are creative, independent, artistic types, you know, data types, computational computer types, to produce something like the scene in his prior movie, Up, where Carl and Ellie, you know, just sort of reflect upon their life together. I don't know if you remember that montage of their falling in love and living a life together. Mm. And I was just like, I mean, that is an incredible piece of leadership, right? To unite 250 different people to produce something like that. And what I quickly discovered, Chris, was, you know, Pete embodies these principles of collaborative power. He's really respectful. He's a spectacular listener. He is, you know, sharing and kind and really interested in giving intellectual and artistic opportunities to young people. He's strong. He fights for the key ideas that he really cares about. And when I, for 5 years, I would go around Pixar, you know, and have lunch with people and meet different members of the team, animators, illustrators, and the like. And to a person, they're like, Pete Docter is the most amazing person to work for, right? And that quality that distributed throughout his network brought out their best work. And it really, it just brought to life all these abstract ideas I was working on in the Power Paradox.
So if our listener wants to be like him, what can they do?
Oh, man. Well, you know, what I think you can do, you know, and I wrote about this in the Harvard Business Review piece that got a really good response, which is, you know, here's, and, you know, I'm happy to share it with you and you can post it. But, you know, there are just 6 or 7 things you can always be trying to do in each interaction, since power is part of every interaction in your life. And, you know, you can be really orienting empathically to other people's interests. You can be really cultivating respect, because we know power and feeling powerful makes people less respectful, makes people almost uncivil in how they speak and act. You can be bold, right? And take some chances. Yeah, it offer a really cool, one of your favorite ideas at a team meeting. You can, and then you got to watch out for the really coercive types that are coming after you. So there are a lot of concrete things to do that are a basis of enduring power.
I'm gonna hold you a little to the fire here in a moment.
Sure.
People often associate power with body language. So basically, appearing powerful makes you more powerful. Appearing not powerful makes you not powerful. I guess the first question in that arena is, I mean, how does appearance really play a role versus your words and actions?
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because, you know, so there are, part of this is a performance, right? People who study organizations call it status moves. Like, do you show, you know, grand generosity? Hey, dinner's on me, everybody. And suddenly you gain in the respect of your colleagues. Or do you have witty remarks that show an emotional intelligence in a meeting? So part of it is performative, there's no doubt. And, you know, there are these really interesting studies of Machiavellians and narcissists. And Machiavellians and narcissists, and it's part, there are two out of the three what are called the dark triad in personality, the other one being sociopathy or sort of, you know, sociopathology. Machiavellians and narcissists are full of like seductive charm and grandiosity and overconfidence, and they kind of will take people down, and they show this bluster, right? Probably reminds you of the president-elect, perhaps. Hmm. And what's really interesting is they have this performative style, studies show, that gets them power initially. People are like, whoa, you know, did you see that guy? He really took that other person down, and he was promising all this great stuff, and he seemed as though he could not possibly make a mistake. And he had all this surge of confidence. But over time, people catch on to narcissists and Machiavellians. And after a while, after a few interactions or a few weeks or months with them in an organization, for example, they kind of get the feeling like, wow, I can't trust this person. Or this person's actually really only interested in their own self-interest and not the group's functioning. And their power tends to diminish. So yes, this is a performance. Yes, we can be tricked initially, but I think strong social systems tend to catch on to these problematic types.
You're saying enduring power is going to be not these kind of narcissistic blustering, but in your book, you know, here's what I'm noticing. In your book, you talk about, you know, you grew up in this low power community, yeah. That was very empathetic and very nice, yeah. And yet they were low power. And at the same time, we look at the body language, and again, it's showing high power. So maybe showing egotistic behavior is a way to get power, and showing generosity is actually, you know, a showing that you have no power. How do you marry that?
Well, I think we have to look at, you know, I think there's no simple solution, and don't you hate it when scientists say that? But I think that when you put together this wealth of data that we now have that ranges from school kids to U.S. presidents to people in the military to, you know, Cameron Anderson's type work on how do you get power in newly forming groups in the lab. It is this complex array of strategies. And what people care about is, you know, you do have to speak up and be bold. And that is not necessarily, you know, kind and pro-social. But at the same time, you have to show a set of qualities that build trust in the people around you, that you really care about other people, that you are a great listener. And so you need this complex mixture that isn't, you know, it isn't just being the kind monk that gets you power, because you need to be bold and strong and assertive. The people got to know what you believe, right? But at the same time, the strength of your ideas will not last if you don't have a constituency that will enact them and work upon them. And that's founded upon your reputation and trust. So you need this complex mixture.
How would this show up in, I'm going to run through a common thing. Let's say you're in a job interview. How would that show up?
Well, it shows up really simply, which is, you know, does somebody with heart convey sort of their core passions and what they really will bring to the work? And that's the boldness that we're talking about. Does somebody show qualities that show that they're good at connecting to others? Do they listen well? Do they ask good questions? Do they laugh in a contagious way? Do they feel warm? And those qualities mean downstream that they're going to be a strong team member and build alliances and do excellent collaborative work, right? And then there's the, you know, alongside the boldness and the warmth, you know, with these subsidiary strategies we've been talking about, is, you know, just kind of basic competence. Does this person have the skill set? And this is typically what people look for, you know, skill set to be a great president or a great coder at Facebook or a terrific illustrator at Pixar. You got to have skills. So, you know, I think that intuitively we know that we pick up these qualities, and the mind has, you know, the brain has big regions that are devoted to detecting them. And that's what you look for in interviews, is that mixture of EQ and talent and skills and, you know, the ability to be a strong member of a team.
Okay, let's take another common situation. What if you're in a meeting?
Yeah. Well, what I, you know, it's so interesting. I work with a couple of groups that studies show, and by their own report, that team meetings can be a little, you know, a little tricky for them, right? Because they're so fast-paced and really talkative, assertive people can dominate the floor and the like. You know, I work with individuals in a Norwegian organization, and Norwegians are notoriously collaborative and non-assertive. And I work with a lot of, you know, women in positions of leadership, and women tend to be a little bit more collaborative. And, you know, when I ask these groups of 50 women, like, do you regularly feel like you don't get to say what you would hope to say at a team meeting? 80% of hands shoot up. So what I tell people to do is, you know, make sure as a principal you voice your ideas, speak up, make sure that you ask great questions, make sure that you are doing things that you know, that allow you to informally comment on the quality of the ideas that are being developed. Like you engage empathically. There are studies that show when you're in a team meeting and if you're just voicing interest and laughing and sort of nodding your head in ways that affirm the ideas on the table, you will be contributing to a better product, to greater innovation. So I think there's this whole array of things from speaking up to nonverbal engagement to, you know, building alliances and the like that are essential to your status within that team.
That's really good. Looking at the research on power, you know, pleasing and facilitating the relationship is often considered a low power behavior. Yeah. And how does that differ from being generous and listening?
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's there can be generosity and empathic listening without purpose, right? Without boldness, without a sense that that individual has a core intention or passion about the collaboration or the work together. And, you know, what really strikes me, you know, and it's kind of brought up, Chris, in this conversation is the great leaders I've been around, you know, product manager, a woman who's a product manager at Facebook. Some of the women that I was just with, Kaiser Permanente, literally influencing the health of millions of people, you know, Pete Docter, the Dalai Lama, you know, I've been in the Dalai Lama's presence intensively for a couple of times. And they do the soft stuff we've been talking about, listening warmly, really showing caring about the person's other people's condition, sharing, but they have boldness, right? And they will fight for what they believe in. And that mixture is, I think, the magic ingredient of showing the warm stuff, but really knowing what you're after. And when you don't know that stuff and you're not bold, you will seem weak. You'll seem like you're supplicating and just begging. So you got to know what you're after. You know, it's interesting when historians write about Abraham Lincoln, they really zero in on this quality, which is that he knew he had to end slavery, you know, the defining issue of this country's history. But at the same time, he knew it was not so simple as just declaring this boldly. He had to work collaboratively with counterparts and skeptics and extremists, if you will, to get that done. So it was this mixture of warmth and boldness.
That's really great. That gives so much insight into how it all comes together. Really, the listening, the empathy, but it's in the context of this greater good, in some sense, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and you know, it's so interesting. Like when historians rank the legacies of the great U.S. presidents, the ones who have the great legacies had ideas, bold ideas that lasted. Right, not flash in the pan manipulative notions or dramatic gestures, but bold ideas like FDR's ideas, or, you know, on the other end of the political spectrum, Ronald Reagan about small government, even though he had a large government. But, you know, so they had these bold ideas and then they delivered them in ways that got alliances to pursue them, you know, and networks to pursue them.
All right, let's get to the core then of, we know what the behaviors of power look like, and I think to some degree, maybe our listeners can act them. But what are some practices we can take to experience a sense of our own power?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that's so interesting is the first challenge is actually something I write about in the Power Paradox, which is something that cultures have been doing universally, which is cultures very often will have young people go out on what's called a vision quest, where their central task is to figure out how they're going to make a difference in the world, right? And today, organizational psychologists talk about that as purpose. Like, you know, you may be cleaning hospital pans in a medical care setting, or you may be a data analyst on a team, or you may be in HR, and you got to think like, why am I here? you know, and so you find your purpose. And purpose and power are very tightly intertwined. The second thing, and I now do this with the groups that I teach, really high-level executives, is to engage in a collective conversation about, like, let's talk about the specific context in which you really feel powerful, right? And it's so interesting, Chris. I ask it in this open-ended way at the start of my work with different groups, and out come exactly the stuff we've been talking about, where people will say, you know, I worked so hard for years to get this compensation group to include this as part of the retirement package, and it worked after years, and it's about advancing the greater good. Or I felt really powerful when I brought up these three junior colleagues to take on leadership positions, and I enabled that. So power is about, when you think about the specific context of your life, of how you're applying your purpose. And then I think that, you know, it is this repertoire of tactics or strategies we've been talking about. Like, okay, you know, I'm dealing with this person. How do I cultivate empathy or respect or be strong or bold or make sure I don't get pushed around or, you know, show kindness and share resources? So I think it's this mixture of the deep existential work of, like, what's my purpose? Secondly is, you know, how do I, where am I in my daily life at work and in my family, where is it playing out? Am I getting in power struggles with my teenagers at the dinner table? Okay, let's figure that out. And third is these strategies or tactics we've been talking about.
That's great. So these are things to keep in mind if we're going to go into, you know, a very high stakes meeting, let's say, with our manager. We could come up with this beforehand.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. And nowadays, you know, I manage, my lab has 20 people. I help manage a greater good science center. That's 10 people. I'm part of committees. So I'm, like, interacting with 30 or 40 different kinds of people, all with careers on the line. And I make sure I'm kind of working through these ideas here in each interaction, right? What's this person's purpose? What's our intention? Where are we, you know, where do we have rough edges in our power dynamics? How can I really listen well, et cetera? So absolutely every context, these are alive and ready to be applied.
Wow. So you as a leader, I would almost say that's super leadership, and that what you're doing is you're looking not only your purpose, but the purposes of your other colleagues and then helping them with those.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's so funny because I'm rooted in the science and I've been teaching this for 15, 20 years. One of my colleagues, Morten Hansen, works with Collins, the Good to Great author, you know, and quickly people would be telling me, you know, in Good to Great, one of the big bestsellers on leadership, really one of the most influential books in leadership, period. You know, the final level of leadership is serving the purposes of other people. And I believe that to my core. That's what it all rests upon.
What's really nice about everything you're saying is that their internal practices.
Yeah.
I think powerlessness and the cost to ourself, you know, sometimes we associate it with the external circumstances. And you've given some tools to really counter that. I'm just curious how much of power and powerlessness is a factor of our thinking versus our external situation.
I think it's a nuanced answer. And what we know, so, you know, the powerlessness question of poverty and, you know, being, you know, treated in a problematic way by a school system or a criminal justice system that's been well documented, a lot of that is the context. And if you are born in the worst, you know, like in the neighborhood I grew up around, where you just don't have a shot with schools and, you know, you're just facing a tricky system, an adversarial system, probably 70% is in your context. And it's, you got to really work hard to use that 30% of your mindset and your social practices to rise to a better position. And then, and this is a claim based on data I could bore you with. And then, you know, if you're born into a middle-class setting and or upper middle class and you're rising and you're working in organizations you and I connect to, a lot of it is your mindset and is how you handle stress and how you handle complex colleagues and how you speak up and how you stay close to ethical principles as you rise. So a lot is in your choice.
Well, let's talk about situations like dealing with colleagues, because I have a colleague whose boss is extremely demanding her. He literally calls her and texts her all the time. He doesn't respect her work boundaries or her personal boundaries. So she's kind of stuck in this very low power position of always reacting to him. What advice would you give her?
So, you know, it's funny. For 20 years, I've been teaching good power, and then people are always like, but I got this person in my organization who's derailing me. And regrettably, studies show men are more likely to perpetrate problematic behavior, and they're more likely to direct it to women. So your example is illustrative. And there are nice strategies that have been thought through and worked out by people like Bob Sutton down at Stanford, who has his book, The No Asshole Rule. How do you deal with these people? You know, forgive the swearing. And it boils down to some simple things like take the high road. Don't, if you got a bully, don't fight back because that's what they love. Sort of stay close to civility and the protocols of your organization. Get allies, right? Call out the behavior. Sutton, in his writings, has like, here are 12 behaviors that are really unacceptable. Things like interrupting and bullying and shaming and snubbing are unacceptable in today's organizations. Make it a strong culture where you call out these kinds of behaviors. If calling it out and taking the high road and getting your allies and that doesn't work, then, you know, sadly, it's time to think about moving on, because some of these people are incorrigible and will take organizations down.
I'm taking notes here of some of the things you're saying. No Asshole Rules, the book that some of these things are laid out in.
Yeah, Bob said.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, the worst case scenario that you have to leave your job. So I guess that would be the same thing. I have this question here I wanted to ask you, which is, how do you respond or counter someone's overt power gestures?
Well, one of the things, I think there are a couple of really useful things about, you know, the power paradox and then the teaching that I've been doing, which is, first of all, it teaches you how to be aware of it, right? What are the things that dominators do, right? They are going to interrupt you. They're going to bully your ideas. They may snub you at a meeting, right? They may hold their bodies with their arms behind their heads and kick their feet up on your table. There are a lot of things that coercive domineering types do. And awareness really helps. You know, there's a rich literature on how powerful it is to be aware of stress, sources of stress in your environment. When I'm being dominated, I'm like, oh, here we go. Here come the strategies coming at me. And I'm aware. And then the second thing, I think this is where the performative side to power is really important, which is, you know, I teach people, like, here's what you can do non-verbally, like fold your arms and close your arms and move back and you know, tell them that their idea is really condescending and so forth. So put it on record and counter with your own peaceful strength. And those are a couple of sort of useful in the moment strategies. And then we get back to, like, if you're countering somebody's really problematic power moves, you turn to allies and build up a network where people are aware of these problematic behaviors.
I wrote a book on startup pitching. I'm really trying to think of, let's say that I'm going to go into an investor meeting. So I don't have a relationship with this person. I don't have an organization around which to seek allies per se in that situation. Yep. So, and let's say, you know, intentionally, particularly in Silicon Valley, you get these investors who are just very, you know, full of their ego.
Yeah.
And you want to be heard. And when you walk in and they're interrupting you and doing all this stuff right away, I mean, what's a way that you can carve out a space for you to share your ideas and be heard?
Well, you know, I think, you know, this is something that I've done a lot of teaching around, and it's almost rhetoric and the nonverbals of a powerful presentation, right? And there are, and I do this work with Adobe and other groups around the Bay Area and elsewhere. And it really is about, like, if you have, you know, 3 to 5 minutes of somebody's listening time, what can you do with your body and your voice and your delivery to really make it powerful to make it something that people listen, remember, not interrupt you about. And it is things, there are rhetorical strategies that you can follow about how to construct a good argument and, you know, make it strong, make it principled with facts and precedent, make it bold, make it, you know, really imaginative. And then there are things you can do non-verbally that really capture people, right? You can use your voice. You can make sure your body is calm, avoid nervous gestures, you know, use your eye contact, ask great questions. And, you know, people have been thinking about this since Aristotle of how, what makes for the great persuasive rhetoric. And we have good answers to it. So there are things about constructing great pitches. There are things about delivery that are pretty time-tested and useful.
All right. Two more questions. First is, I remember reading about, and this might have been body language research, that there are, when a person takes a high power position in body position, they're more comfortable with the interaction. Both people are more comfortable with the interaction when one takes a low power and one takes a high power. If they both take high power, they're uncomfortable. If they both take low power, they're uncomfortable. So when is it important to play high power versus low power? When's it okay to play low power?
Well, there are a lot of contexts, right? I think, you know, what you're referring to is work by Lara Tedens at Stanford that, you know, we tend to feel comfortable in these more hierarchical dynamics. And I think that, but you can ask like a, you know, and Cameron Anderson has been doing really cool work showing if you get groups of people together and all they do is do their power moves vis-a-vis each other, particularly men, they end up doing worse work together because they're just, you know, getting into these escalating status moves and power dynamics. So I think that I think it's okay to show power, A, to return to your last question, when you're at the critical moment of like, this is the most important idea I have, period. This is what I should get venture capital for. This is why my paper should be published. This is why you should marry me, right? You need conviction and power behind that, non-verbally. B, there are moments in that, and it's interesting, for 20 years, this is work beginning at Stanford's Business School and now at Berkeley, I've been analyzing the nonverbal behaviors of executives negotiating. And there are certain times in negotiations, negotiation is this complicated multi-phase interaction, where you really want to show power and strength. You want to show it when you're expressing your position, like what you need in a negotiation. That actually benefits both sides. You want to show it if you get pushback and if somebody's trying to manipulate you. It's good to show a little power in return. So I think that those are three examples of where it's good to show power, is when you're really expressing your core interests or convictions, when you're kind of within more specific negotiations, stating your position, and then when someone's trying to manipulate you, it's good to just be tough and show some resilience.
Dacher, that's fantastic. Actually, that's a fantastic note to end this on, because I think that's really useful advice for everybody listening. Thank you so much for taking time today to answer all these questions.
These have been amazing questions, Chris. Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.